company that owned him was in the mood to flush away a multi-billion dollar property. I was a real person, and I wasn't worth multiple billions to anyone. I ventured into lightless realms, although tentatively at first, sliding one hand along a display case. My other hand was extended in front of me, alternately anticipating a wall where an empty air should be, and feeling the floor to avoid a sudden drop-off or debris. At the rate I was going, I wouldn't escape the three searchers, and even if I did elude them, I'd die of thirst or starvation before I got to the pillowcase of tools that I pictured in my mind's eye. I'd always assumed that my gift was just that, a gift, not the result of a rare gene or of some beneficial brain damage related to my mother's consumption of martinis during her pregnancy. A gift like mine seemed to come from some higher power, and whatever the source, whether God or space aliens or wizards living in a parallel Earth where magic worked, it must be a benign higher power, because I was motivated to help the innocent and afflict the guilty. I had no desire to use my abilities to amass colossal wealth or to rule the planet with either a velvet glove or an iron fist. Taking a deep breath, all but totally blind, trusting in my psychic magnetism as Spidey trusted in his web spinning, as Wile E. Coyote trusted in products sold by Acme to snare or kill the Roadrunner, I rose somewhat and, in the hunched posture of an ape, hurried forward. If trash of any kind littered the floor, I didn't once set foot on it. If there were obstacles in my way, I didn't collide with them. Intuitively, I turned this way, that way, this way, marveling at my ability to navigate successfully and with hardly a sound. I had always been in awe of Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles, blind men who sat at their pianos and never played a bad note, absolutely certain of where the keys were in relation to their fingers. I dared to feel a connection with them, though I had no more musical talent than a rock. Standing taller, moving rapidly and successfully through total darkness, I thrilled to the experience, as sometimes I had thrilled to Stevie's and Ray's piano work. The searchers fell far behind me. I couldn't see even the most indirect glow of their lights. I couldn't hear them, either, though perhaps because my heart was pounding so hard that the blood rush roar in my ears was like my own private Niagara. With my right shoulder, I brushed against something. Only the slightest contact, but it alarmed me, and I stopped. I turned, felt around me as if in a game of blind man's bluff. I discovered a doorless doorway, the cold metal jams slightly oily to the touch. I thought I knew where I was. This must be the stockroom that had once supplied the sporting goods department, from which stairs led down to the employees-only level, under the mall. On the day of the mass murder, when I'd passed through this place in the grip of psychic magnetism, desperately seeking the gunman, Simon Varner, before he could kill, I had encountered a pretty redhead, busily pulling small boxes off packed storage shelves. She'd said, "Hey," in a friendly way, and I'd said, "Hey," and I'd kept moving through the door and onto the sales floor, expecting the dreadful sound of gunfire at any moment, which had come only a few minutes later. Now I heard a voice. A woman, but not the redhead. One of the searchers. She was shouting, excited. I was too far away to hear exactly what she said, but I caught the word footprints. The mall had been abandoned for many months. Time might have laid a thin carpet of dust, probably not everywhere, but here and there, revealing part of the route I'd taken. Suddenly, out there beyond the stockroom, a flashlight flared, another, a third. They were closer than I expected. Picturing the pillowcase full of tools once more, I hurried across the stockroom, stopped, felt a door jam where I expected it, and stepped blindly onto the first step of the two flights of stairs that led down to the mall's underworld. Using the railing to steady myself, I descended as far as the mid-floor landing before I heard voices above. Perhaps not in the stockroom yet, but approaching it. I hustled down the last flight, eased open the fire door just far enough to slip through, closed it as quietly as possible, and switched on my flashlight. Here, in the wide service corridor, dust hadn't settled as it had in the high-ceilinged, cavernous sales floor above. I'd left no footprints on my way in, and I would leave none on my way out. From the stairwell behind me came an eager voice, footsteps descending. If I followed the route by which I had originally entered the mall, there was nowhere close to hide. The two freight elevators featured openwork steel gates instead of solid sliders. Farther away were the double doors to the loading dock, which I couldn't possibly reach before the cultist arrived and saw me. I turned in the opposite direction, where there were rooms on the left side of the corridor. I hurried to the nearest door, opened it, switched off my flashlight, and crossed the threshold as I heard my pursuers spilling out of the stairwell. As I quietly shut the door, a stench rose around me. The stink of rot and feces and sulfur and, strangely, ammonia, so intense that I gagged and my eyes watered. I dared not step farther into whatever living nightmare might await me, but I couldn't flee to the corridor either. I eased to my left and pressed my back to the wall. The hinges immediately to my right made a grinding, bone-on-bone sound as the door opened. The nameless woman rattled off a series of colorful words to express her disgust at the malodor and at the sight that her flashlight revealed. Approximately 40 feet on a side, the room offered foot-deep mounds of whitish matter, streaked with gray and mottled with yellow, nearly all of it heaped toward the back half of the space. The stuff glistened in many places, lay dry and cracked and pocked in others, and busy beetles scurried across it, like miniature mechanical moon rovers exploring the surface of an airless world. Here and there, bristling from the hideous mass, were dark, twisted, spiky things that, after a moment, I realized must be dead bats that were especially interesting to the beetles. The woman's flashlight beam traveled up to a wall-to-wall grid of metal rods suspended a foot below the true ceiling, from which perhaps merchandise had once been hung while it awaited delivery to the stores overhead. The filth-encrusted rods were less interesting than the bats depending from them. The flourishing colony hung for the most part in sleep, but the traveling light encouraged a few to open eyes that glowed like yellow-orange jewels. Wolfgang, the guy with the whiskied voice, cursed and said, "Close the damn door, Celine." Fortunately, Celine didn't slam it. She eased the door shut, as though she had accidentally lifted the lid of Dracula's coffin and, being without garlic or a pointed stake, hoped to slip away before the thirsty count bestirred himself. I heard the trio talking in the corridor, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. Inhaling the disgusting odor of dung and rot and musk, I stood with my back to the wall and waited for one of the bats to squeak. One of them did. Then another. 6. Amaranth. Between the rescue of the kidnapped children in Nevada and my return to Pico Mundo, I lived for 2 months in a cozy 3-bedroom seaside cottage with Anna Maria. It was in this charming house, in late May, on the night before I would ride the big dog motorcycle across the Mojave, that I had the dream of the amaranth. Having met in late January, on a pier in the town of Magic Beach, farther up the coast from where we lived now, Anna Maria and I were friends, never paramours. But we were more than friends, because she was, like me, more than she appeared to be. During the 4 months that I'd known her, she'd been 8 months pregnant. She claimed that she'd been pregnant not merely 8 months, but a long time, and she said that she would be pregnant longer still. She never spoke of the father, and she seemed to live without worry about her future. Many things she said made no sense to me, but I trusted her. She wrapped herself in mystery and had some purpose that I could not comprehend, but she never lied, never betrayed, and compassion shone forth from her as light from the sun. Neither a great beauty nor plain, she had flawless skin, large dark eyes, and long dark hair. She never wore other than sneakers, elastic waist khakis, and baggy sweaters. Because she was petite in spite of her swollen belly, she always looked like a waif, though she claimed to be 18. She sometimes called me young man. I was 4 years older than Anna Maria, but this habit of hers also seemed right. I knew her only hours when she told me that she had enemies who would kill her and her unborn child if they got the chance. She'd asked if I would die for her, and I had surprised myself by saying at once, yes. Although she pretended that I served as her valiant protector, she did more to pull me out of one dangerous place or another than I ever did for her. On the night that I dreamed of the Amaranth, Anna Maria and I, and the 9-year-old boy named Tim, slept in our separate rooms in the cottage. A golden retriever, Raphael, shared the child's bed. Rescued 3 months earlier from horrific circumstances, Tim now had no family but us. I've written of him in the 7th volume of these memoirs and won't repeat myself in this 8th. In Greek mythology, the amaranth was an undying flower that remained at the peak of its beauty for eternity. But the dream did not begin with the flower. From a peaceful sleep, I plunged into a nightmare of chaos and cacophony. Screaming rose all around me. Some of the voices were fraught with terror, but an equal number seemed to shriek with a glee that was more disturbing than the fearful cries. Wound among all the human voices was another tapestry of grotesque sound. Chirr and howl and ululation, bray and squeal and clangor. Much light in many colors whirled and throbbed, yet did not illuminate. Racing streams of red and yellow and blue smeared across my eyes and blurred my vision. I could not understand what little I was able to see. A giant stone wheel, 3 or 4 stories high, rolling straight toward me at tremendous velocity. Faces swelling like balloons about to burst, but then shrinking as they deflated. Hundreds of hands simultaneously grasping at me and thrusting me away. 7. The deserts of California in the Southwest provide a sustaining environment for a variety of bats. Earlier, I hadn't been surprised to see them swarming out of a cave mouth at the bottom of the ravine into which the Cadillac Escalade plunged, but I had not the slightest expectation of finding them in a shopping mall basement, not even if the mall was long abandoned and awaiting a wrecking crew. There must have been an exit from this room by which they left to hunt after nightfall and by which they returned each day before dawn, perhaps a ventilation shaft, maybe a chaseway for plumbing or electrical cables. I'd thought the first flight of bats must be an omen, and after this more intimate encounter such a short time later, I had no doubt that the bats augured something. The problem with omens is that they never come with an illustrated pamphlet explaining what they mean. I'm no better at interpreting them than I would be at puzzling out the meaning of a conversation between a guy speaking Uzbek and a guy speaking Eskimo, which I tried to do once when a multilingual Eskimo and a multilingual Uzbekistani were arguing about which one had the best reason to kill me. At that moment, just after Celine had shut the door, closing me in with the stench, I was less concerned about the meaning of signs and portents than about holding down my gorge, which seemed on the verge of leaving my stomach and erupting in a credible imitation of Mount Vesuvius. I stood listening to the voices in the corridor, and to the squeaks and the ruffling of wings as the bats settled down after the brief annoyance of the open door and the intrusion of the flashlight. I gagged, and the residents of the room didn't seem to appreciate the sound I made, perhaps taking it as criticism, so I resolved not to gag again, as I was always loath to give offense. Trapped between the cultists and the winged horde, I tried to remember everything that I knew about bats. My friend Ozzie Boone, the 400-pound best-selling mystery novelist who mentored my own writing, had written a novel that involved murder by bats as a red herring. When Ozzie became fascinated with a new line of research, he insisted on sharing his enthusiasm, no matter how creepy the subject might be. Though vampire bats weren't as disturbing as what he shared when he wrote a story in which the victim was murdered by a personal chef who fed him watercress salads infested with the tiny eggs of liver flukes. Bats were the only mammals that could fly. Flying lemurs and flying squirrels, swooping from one treetop to another, were only gliding. They didn't possess wings to flap. Bats did not get tangled in people's hair. They were not blind. Even in absolute darkness, a bat could find its way by echolocation. Therefore, I suppose that, considering my psychic magnetism, I should have felt some kinship with these creatures. I did not. I never quite gotten a handle on that multicultural thing. Most of the species in the Mojave were insect eaters, though a few fed on cactus flowers and sage blossoms and the like. There were vampire bats, too. The vampires were small, maybe 4 inches, the size of a mouse. They weighed little more than an ounce. Each night, they could eat their own weight in blood. A vampire bat would never kill me, but 1,000 might be seriously draining. Maybe these were vampire bats. Maybe they weren't. Of course they were. Other than griddle work, nothing ever came easy to me. In the pitch-black room, the disturbed colony had grown quieter, most of the restless insomniacs at last joining their blood-crazed companions in slumber, lost in dreams that I would definitely not try to imagine. A soft, brief rustle here, a thin squeak over there, the harmless little noises of the last few weary individuals getting cozy for their morning sleep. Death by vampire bats would be less painful than you might suppose. Their teeth were so exquisitely sharp that you wouldn't even feel the cuts they made. People were rarely bitten by vampire bats, which mostly drank the blood of chickens, cattle, horses, and deer. I didn't find that word rarely as comforting as the word never. In the corridor beyond the closed door, the voices of the three cultists had faded completely away. Their silence didn't mean that they had given up their search for me and had gone back to their usual activities, like strangling babies and torturing kittens. No offense intended to the Satanists who might be reading this, but I found that those who worship the devil tend to be sneaky, more deceitful by far than your average Methodist, and proud of it. They might still be in the mall basement or garage, standing silently in the darkness, waiting for me to show myself, whereupon my life would be worth spit, and in fact less than spit. Some people believe that a vampire bat is attracted by the smell of blood, that you have to be bleeding, even if from a tiny puncture or a scratch, before the little beast will be drawn to you in a feeding frenzy. That is not true. Instinctively, bats know that any creature that sweats also bleeds. If a molecule or two of sweat floating on the air found its way into the folds of their nostrils, they would twitch their whiskers and bare their razor-edged teeth and lick their thin lips and, in the current situation, be pleased by the realization that someone had ordered takeout and it had been delivered. I was perspiring. Something crawled off my shirt and onto my throat and explored the contours of my Adam's apple. Over the years, after numerous shocks and horrific encounters, my nerves had become as steady as solid-state circuitry. I figured one of the beetles that had been eating the dead bats in the dung pile had found its way up my body, too light to have been felt through my clothes. Instead of shrieking like Little Miss Muffet, I reached up to my throat and captured the insect in my fist. Because of the ick factor, I didn't want to crush the bug. But when I attempted to throw it back toward the dung pile from which it had come, The vicious little thing stuck to my hand with the tenacity of a tick. Ozzie Boone had written a novel in which the villain threw one of his victims, an IRS agent, into a pit seething with carnivorous beetles. In spite of the taxman's flailing, stomping, and desperate attempts to climb out of that hellhole, the voracious swarm killed him in 6 minutes and stripped his bones of every last scrap of flesh in 3 hours and 10 minutes. Not as rapidly as piranhas might have done the job, but impressive nonetheless. Sometimes I wished that my mentor had been Danielle Steele. I opened my right hand, in which the beetle had gotten a death grip on my palm, made a catapult of the forefinger and thumb of my left hand, and flung the noxious little bugger back into the reeking darkness. I hadn't heard a sound from the three cultists in a few minutes, and as I listened intently to the occasional bat rearrange its wings around itself, as though adjusting its blanket, I wondered if the castaway beetle had been an outlier, more adventurous than others of its kind. Or, even now, were numerous others exploring my shoes and climbing the legs of my jeans? If I have machine-like steady-state nerves, I unfortunately also have the imagination of an acutely sensitive, hyperactive 4-year-old on a sugar high, a 4-year-old with an understanding of death equal to that of a war veteran. Although I felt certain I would die here in Pico Mundo within days, I told myself that the fatal moment had not yet arrived, and that it was not my fate to be beetled to death. I would have been reassured if I hadn't lied to myself often in the past. I was about to bolt from beetles, real and imagined, from bats, sleeping or not, when I heard a door slam in some far region of the basement, and I concluded that the cultists must still be searching for me. I had not seen their faces. Although I knew their first names, they were anonymous. A strange thought disturbed me. If they should kill me, and if we met eventually in some place beyond the grave, they would know me, but I would not know them. Given more time to recall what I had learned about bats from Ozzie Boone, I remembered that a minimum 30% of any colony would reliably be infected with rabies. Darkness so perfect it made my eyes ache, the fetid air so thick that the stink became also a foul taste, the whispery sounds of the carnivorous beetles feeding on the tiny carcasses of rabies-infected bats, the occasional ruffle of wings as members of the colony stirred in their sleep, the expectation that they would abruptly take flight and prove Ozzie wrong regarding their affinity for human hair. In that poisonous atmosphere, I became more disoriented minute by grim minute. Decomposing dung releases sulfurous gas, deadly in sufficient concentration, and if not ultimately lethal here, at least capable of making me lightheaded, even delirious. I grew convinced that a time would soon come when, like an astronaut in zero gravity, I would have no sense of up or down. If I dropped the flashlight, I just knew I wouldn't be able to locate it, and when I attempted to escape this room, the door wouldn't be where I expected to find it. Alarmed by what, I do not know, the entire colony erupted from the overhead grid of rods from which they hung, and they broke into what seemed to be chaotic flight, though according to Ozzie, there was always orderliness in bat formations, each individual aware of its assigned position. At once, I slid down against the concrete wall until I was squatting, trying to stay well below their flight path, the multitude of shrill voices giving rise to goose flesh on my goose flesh. Their squeaking is why people think of them as flying rodents. And although they really aren't rodents, I felt as if I were in some whacked-out low-budget movie about a rat storm. Their wings beat 14 times a second. Another bit of trivia, courtesy of Ozzie. Although none of them brushed against me as they whirled around the room, I felt the wind of their passage, which stirred even more intense odors from the air, as surely as a chef's ladle would stir more appealing aromas from a soup pot. However they might have exited, they didn't leave by the door. The flutter of their wings inspired sympathetic vibrations deep in my ears, so that I shivered uncontrollably until their numbers had significantly diminished. then the last were gone. Silence fell upon the room in their wake, and I rose to my full height, shaken and nauseated. When the bats erupted out of the maw by whatever route, they would quickly realize that dawn was coming. The day world was not theirs, and the moment that their alarm subsided and instinct guided them once more, they would return. Perhaps in the next minute or two. Agitated. Bats were capable of anger, especially vampire bats. The males frequently fought. I didn't want to hang around to find out if they would ignore me or instead focus on me as the primary object of their rage. The door featured a lever handle that worked with a minimum of noise. I opened it, wincing at the faint creak of the hinges, and faced a service corridor as pitch black as the room behind me. For a moment, I listened to the eerie quiet, cocking my head to the left, to the right. If Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine were still lurking in the immediate vicinity, they should have heard the exodus of the bats, even through the closed door, should have switched on their flashlights and found me when I was betrayed by the hinges. I stepped across the threshold and eased the door shut behind me. By comparison to the wretched stink I'd just escaped, the air here smelled so sweet that I wanted to draw great, noisy breaths, but in the interest of avoiding a bullet in the head, I refrained. After listening for another half minute, I clicked on my light. Solid-state nerve circuitry didn't serve me well, because I jumped when, from behind, a hand gripped my shoulder. I turned and found Rob Norwich, my recent spirit guide, no longer glowing, but with his face again blown away. 8. Rob Norwich's eyeless sockets, fragmentary nose, lipless mouth, broken facial bones, and other elements of bloody ruin were, as far as I was concerned, not conducive to conversation, whether in that gloomy mall basement or in a sunny park. "Sir," I whispered, "you have to stop coming up behind me, and I'd be grateful if you kept your face on." The ravaged countenance faded, and the gentle features of the English teacher replaced it. His expression said, "Sorry." "Are those three still here somewhere? Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine?" He shook his head. "They've left the mall?" He nodded. "Sorry I didn't follow you to the other department store, sir, but going there wasn't the right thing." He nodded again. Having a conversation with a dead guy can be duller than you might think. Only someone in love with his own voice could be routinely enchanted by the experience. Usually, lingering spirits come to me because, whether they realize it or not, they want me to talk them into moving on from this world. A couple of them have even been celebrities, who were loath to leave this realm where they had been loved by so many. I've written about Mr. Presley and Mr. Sinatra in other volumes of this memoir, both of whom had been thornier problems for me than I imagined a former English teacher would be. "Is there something I can do for you, Mr. Norwich?" He shrugged. "You're afraid to cross over to the other side. Is that it, sir?" He held one hand out, palm down, and rocked it back and forth, a gesture of equivocation. Maybe he was afraid to cross over. Maybe he wasn't. He didn't want to commit himself to an opinion. He was dead, but he wanted to keep his options open. Although he'd been an English teacher, he was acting like a lawyer. "Sir, your wife and daughter are already over there. Do you believe that?" He nodded. "Don't you want to join them?" He nodded. Then he held out both hands, palms up, and raised his eyebrows, as if inquiring about something. "You're wondering what it's like over there?" He nodded vigorously. "Well, not having been there, sir, I can't describe it. But my girlfriend, Stormy Llewellyn, she believed this life is the first of three. She called it boot camp. She said we're here just to prepare ourselves for a second life of service in some great adventure beyond our imagination. She thought it might be like The Lord of the Rings, but with more magic, more danger, worse things than orcs, maybe with no elves, though she had nothing against elves. Maybe like Tolkien with a noir edge. Something that would have roles for Bogart and Mitchum if it were a movie. And John Wayne, for sure. Mr. Norwich just stared at me. It was my turn to shrug. I'm not saying that's what it's like, sir. It's just Stormy's theory. Like purgatory, see? But a lot more colorful than we usually think of it. Anyway, whatever the second life is like, once we get to our third and eternal life, then it's all very sweet, you know? Lovely and wondrous and perfect and happy-making. He cocked his head and regarded me as he might have a student who'd failed to read an assignment and was trying to fake his way through a discussion of Milton's Paradise Lost. Just take the leap, sir. What have you got to lose, other than the misery of ghosting around in this life where you don't belong anymore? Mr. Norwich shook his head. No, I had not convinced him, and he dematerialized. There one moment, but gone the next. I hate it when they do that. I find it rude. You'd think he could have at least waved bye-bye or patted me on the head. In the nearby suburban Bat Cave, the colony returned with a demonic symphony of squeaking and the beating of many wings, angry to have been spooked from their roosts. Okay, an omen. Meaning what? I asked. But the closed door said nothing more to me than had the mute spirit of the English teacher. With my flashlight, I found my way out of the service corridor, onto the subterranean loading dock, down to the employee garage, and to the violated door where I had left the pillowcase containing my burglary tools. Outside, the May sun had mostly risen. The cloudless sky was sapphire blue in the west, lighter blue overhead, coral pink in the east, reminiscent of an old Wurlitzer jukebox. At the top of the ramp down which 18-wheelers had once driven daily, I stopped to examine my shirt and jeans, my shoes, expecting liberal splatters of bat dung. To my surprise, I appeared both to have escaped bombardment and to have avoided stepping in anything disgusting. Hesitantly, I combed one hand through my hair, but by some miracle, I had also escaped the indignity of a poo shampoo. Nevertheless, I needed a shower, and I wanted one more than I needed it. But not yet. Wary that one of the cultists might have been posted to watch for me, feeling dangerously exposed, I crossed what seemed like 100 acres of blacktop to the exit. Earlier, I'd used the bolt cutter to sever the chain that held shut the gate to the fenced parking lot. I had left the motorcycle in a nearby residential neighborhood of modest homes shaded by massive old ficus trees. No one was abroad at that hour, except for one rangy coyote slinking down the center of the street, reluctant to give up the night's hunt, looking left and right, hoping to find a house cat for breakfast or perhaps even a small child who had disobeyed his mother and had come outside alone. Somehow the driver of the Escalade, who had tried to run me down the night before, had known that I would be traveling on the state route, straddling a big dog bulldog bagger. Therefore it made sense that the other cultists might also be looking for the bike. I didn't have a master of disguise kit. I didn't intend to prowl Pico Mundo incognito. However, calling attention to myself didn't make sense either. Later that morning, I would need to ditch the big dog and find other transportation. But first, I had an appointment to keep, and no other wheels to get there. After stowing the pillowcase and tools in one of the saddlebags, I put on my helmet and goggles. I pulled away from the curb and headed toward the coyote. It backed off, but wasn't intimidated. As I drove past the beast, it followed me with a yellow-eyed stare of predatory calculation, sharp teeth revealed in a sneer of contempt. 9. Formed by the construction of a dam, Malo Suerte Lake was immediately east of Pico Mundo, a large, deep body of water with a marina and sandy beaches along the north shore. Associated with one of those beaches, a grassy park offered picnic areas shaded by Phoenix palms and by the spreading branches of massive live oaks. The park had long been popular in warm weather, which was most of the year in Meravia County, but as it offered no campground, I had never before seen anyone there laying out a picnic breakfast less than an hour after dawn. Ozzie Boone had draped a white cloth over one of the concrete slab picnic tables designed and anchored to foil thieves. On the cloth, he had arranged several chafing dishes warmed by Sterno. I drove past him, past the Cadillac that had been customized to accommodate his bulk and weight, and parked the big dog out of sight behind an oak. I hadn't seen him in a few months, since he'd picked me up at St. Bartholomew's Abbey in the Sierra Nevada, where I had for a while lived in the guest house, hoping to find peace and quiet among the monks, finding instead a kind of darkness new to me. As a writer, Ozzie served as my mentor. As a man, he had long been a surrogate father, which I had often needed. My real father had no idea how to fill that role. He'd never shown any desire to do so.
"Dear Odd," he said, enfolding me in a bear hug, "the last time I saw you, I feared you'd lost weight, and now I'm certain of it. You're a shadow of your former self."
"No, sir, I still weigh the same. Maybe I appear smaller to you because you've gotten still larger."
"I am a svelte 435 pounds, and if I can stick to my diet, I hope to be 450 by September."
"I worry about you," I said.
"Yes, you are quite the worrier for one of such tender years. But if obesity were the worst that any of us had to worry about, the world would be an idyllic place. You've probably noticed that it isn't."
"Yes, sir, I've noticed." In a bucket of ice were a carton of orange juice and two of chocolate milk. He had also brought two large thermoses of coffee. He offered those beverages to me, and at my request he poured coffee, black. The mug was large and thick, emblazoned with the words Pico Mundo Grill and the logo of that diner where I had once worked. I figured that the mug might be intended not only as a welcome-back gesture, but also as a subtle suggestion that I return to my old job and put down roots and cease roaming in search of what only home could offer. When I looked up, I saw that he had been watching me as I stared at the mug. He said,
"This is where you belong, Oddie, with those who love you most."
"Sir, you've not only gained weight since I saw you last, you've also become psychic."
"One doesn't need to be psychic to read your mind, Oddie. In spite of all your complications, you are wonderfully transparent."
"I guess I'll take that as a compliment."
"As it was intended."
He picked up a tall glass of chocolate milk, savoring two long swallows before putting it down and dabbing at his faux mustache with a paper napkin.
"When you called, you were as mysterious as the character in one of my novels. You were so discreet, you might as well have been talking in code. Why couldn't we have breakfast in my kitchen?"
"I didn't want to endanger you, sir. Are you sure you weren't followed here?" He sighed.
"If I'd been followed here, dear boy, I wouldn't be here. What trouble has found you this time?"
"The same trouble, sir. Cultists, like those who shot up the mall back then." Ozzie writes noir fiction, and in spite of his rotundity, he thinks of himself as someone who can be a tough guy when the need arises. He does indeed have impressive forearms and considerable courage. But unshed tears rose in his eyes when I mentioned the mall shooting, because he wasn't only my surrogate father. To some extent, he had also fulfilled that role for Stormy, who had been orphaned as a child. "They've come in from out of town," I continued. "They want to make what happened here 2 summers ago seem like nothing."
"In a sense, it was nothing," Ozzie said, tears still standing in his eyes. "Everything barbarians do is nothing. No matter how loudly they insist, it's something."
The coffee had cooled just enough that I could sip it. "Sir, I don't know how many of them are here to do this thing. I don't know their faces, and I only know 3 first names. I'm afraid it's happening sooner than later, too fast for me to get a handle on it." He finished the glass of chocolate milk and put it down on the white tablecloth, and placed the heels of his plump hands over his eyes, rubbing gently, as though he hadn't slept in a long time and was weary. But of course he was blotting the tears and pressing them back. I said, "I had a set to with others of their cult over in Nevada not long ago, and it didn't end well for them. They'd like to kill me. And I can't pretend there wouldn't be an upside to that, but I'd rather stop them first." Lowering his hands from his face, Ozzy said, "Anything happens to you, there's no upside, son. Not for me. There's only so much eating a man can do to keep the world at bay before he loses all taste for food." Rarely am I at a loss for words, but I didn't know what to say to that. I covered my speechlessness with a few sips of coffee. Ozzy reached for the open carton of milk wedged in the bucket of ice, but then decided not to pour any more for himself just yet. He said, "I imagine that through all your adventures, you still held fast to it." I knew what he meant. "Yes, sir." I put down the mug, took out my wallet, and produced the card from the fortune-telling machine. His hand trembled as he held the little pasteboard prediction. He appeared to read it more than once, as though hoping the simple statement might be modified before his eyes. "You are destined to be together forever." But of course the words did not change. Considering the source of the promise and the importance of it, I was confident that it would not be broken, and in fact that it would be kept sooner than later, as long as I did not fail to do what I had been called home to accomplish. As I took the card from him and returned it to my wallet, I said, "Whatever happens next, what most concerns me is that none of my friends should die because of me. If I let that happen, I won't have earned what I've been promised." We turned together toward the sound of a car in a lane that wound through the park. A police cruiser approached and pulled off the pavement to stop half on the graveled shoulder and half on the grass, in the oak shadows, behind Ozzy's Cadillac. Wyatt Porter, chief of police in Pico Mundo, got out of the car, closed the door, and for a moment stood looking at us across the roof of the vehicle. I'd been fortunate enough to have two surrogate fathers when I'd lived in Pico Mundo, and they were both joining me for breakfast in the park. I hadn't seen the chief since I'd left town about 9 months earlier. The last thing he'd said to me was, "I don't know what we'll do without you, son." What we had both done was keep on keeping on, which is all any of us can do. He looked good for a man who'd once been shot in the chest and left for dead, and I was happier than I can say to see how well he appeared to be. He rounded the car and came to us. I found myself smiling, but the chief did not smile. He nodded at Ozzy, and then he stopped in front of me and said, "Do you believe in dreams, Ozzy?" The chief, and very few others, knew about my paranormal talents. He and I had worked together on a number of cases over the years, though he had always concealed my contributions and spared me from being made a media sensation. "Dreams?" I said. "Some are just the mind playing games with itself, and they're not to be taken seriously. But I don't think that's the kind you mean." "I had this same one 3 times in the past week, before you called, and I'm not given to reruns of dreams." As if to forestall what Chief Porter would say next, Ozzy asked him if he wanted juice or milk or coffee. Instead of answering that question, the chief said to me, "3 times before you called, I dreamed you were coming home. And here I am." He shook his head. With basset eyes and bloodhound jowls, the chief's face was proof of gravity's effect. He looked as solemn as time itself when he said, "What I dreamed is that you came home in a coffin." 10. The 5 chafing dishes contained scrambled eggs with black olives and cilantro, ham layered with sautéed onion slices, home fries, seasoned and buttered rice that smelled like popcorn, and in the last one, tamales stuffed with shredded beef and cheese. A bowl of strawberries rested in a larger bowl of cracked ice, and beside the fruit stood a bowl of brown sugar with a serving spoon. Butter and jellies had been provided, too, and a basket of rolls, some sweet and cinnamony, some plain. At the linen-mantled table, we sat together on concrete benches, on thick cushions upholstered in vinyl and supplied by our immense and immensely hospitable host. Ozzy sat at the very end of the slab, while Wyatt Porter and I sat across from each other. We ate and talked. At first, all the conversation was about amusing incidents in the history of Pico Mundo, moments we'd shared. Though humor marked those memories, they were also colored lightly by melancholy. I felt there was something sacred about that breakfast, but at the time I could not have explained what I meant. The air was dry and warm, with the faintest breeze to keep it fresh, and scattered through the oaken shade, across the ground and the table and the three of us, glimmered treasures minted by the sun, coins of golden light. And in the trees, song sparrows and western meadowlarks trilled. But it wasn't the place and its atmosphere that hallowed the moment. Neither was it the sumptuous meal, nor the memories that we shared, nor the fact that we were at last in one another's company again. All of those things contributed to the mood, but the heart of the moment, the truest reason that it felt so pure to me and seemed to have special meaning, remained elusive. Indeed, it would continue to elude me the entire time I spent in Pico Mundo. When we got around to talking about why I had returned to town, the mood darkened. The chief said, "We've been up against their kind before, this same madness, and we took losses, but we're still here." Ozzy shook his head, and his extra chins trembled. "We can't endure more losses like those at Green Moon Mall. This is a town with spirit, but if it takes too many hits to the heart, it'll never be the same. Any town can die without actually drying up and blowing away. It can be as dead as a ghost town, even with people still living in it." Gazing into his mug, as if he were a gypsy and as if coffee could be read like the remnants of tea, the chief said, "They won't make a fool of me like the others did." "Wyatt Porter, you were never a fool," Ozzy declared, in a tone of voice that did not invite debate. "Every man is outfoxed sooner or later, about one thing or another. If criminals were never cunning enough to deceive the authorities, every cop's job would be nothing but make-work, and nobody would want to read my crime novels." I said, "Well, whatever they're planning, they intend it to be the biggest news of the year. And they're not just wannabe Satanists like those the summer before last. These fruitcakes who nearly put an end to me in Nevada are members of a cult first founded back in 1580 in Oxford, England."
"Fanatics with a long heritage of lunacy," Ozzy noted, "tend to be formidable. Their zeal is frenzied, but over generations they have learned to control and focus it."
"They're formidable," I assured him. "They're devoted to the demon Meridian, and though that sounds loopy, they're serious. It's not just fanboy stuff with them, not just freaky costumes, spooky altars with black candles, ritual sex and ritual murder. They don't just celebrate evil. They work hard to bring more of it into the world, to bring upon the world a tidal wave of horror that'll wash hope out of it forever." Evidently, Chief Porter had lost his appetite because he stared at the unfinished cinnamon roll on his plate as if it were a rotting fish.
"Why can't the bad guys be satisfied with just robbing a bank or sticking up a liquor store?"
"You have plenty of that kind of thing to deal with, sir. Think of this as just a little variety." He shook his head.
"No. Year by year, there's less of the your money or your life kind of thing. Less grab the purse and run, less normal crime. Guys who once broke the speed limit by 10 or 15 miles an hour. I'm talking ordinary Joes here, not drug runners or coyotes transporting illegal aliens. These days, some of the idiots do 90 in a 40 zone. When you try to pull them over, they make a run for it. Though running makes no sense, because we got their license plate number. They think they're stunt drivers, masters of evasion, and then they take out a schoolgirl in a crosswalk, or an entire family in a van.
The direction of our conversation hadn't affected Ozzy's appetite. As he lavished butter on a cinnamon roll, he said,
"Perhaps it's the YouTube effect. These police chases rack up lots of views. Everyone wants a taste of fame."
"It's not just that," Chief Porter said. "A guy who once would have raped and killed a woman. Now a lot of times he also has to cut off her lips and mail them to us, or take her eyes for a souvenir and keep them in his freezer at home. There's more flamboyant craziness these days."
Giving the buttered cinnamon roll a reprieve, Ozzy said,
"Maybe it's all these superhero movies with all their supervillains. Some psychopath who used to be satisfied raping and murdering. These days he thinks that he should be in a Batman movie. He wants to be the Joker or the Penguin."
"No real-life bad guy wants to be the Penguin," I assured him.
"Norman Bates was happy just dressing up like his mother and stabbing people," Chief Porter said. "But Hannibal Lecter has to cut off their faces and eat their livers with fava beans. The role models have become more intense."
"I'm not sure it's the role models," Ozzy said. "Maybe it's more related to the pace of change in recent years. Centuries-old ways of looking at the world, centuries-old rules, are jettisoned seemingly overnight. Traditions are mocked and banished. A man, or woman, with an unstable mind sees things falling apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. To a psychopath, anarchy is exciting. The chaotic world reflects his chaotic interior life, confirms his conviction that anything should be allowed, that he can rightly do whatever he wants."
Chief Porter finished the cold coffee in his mug and grimaced either at the bitterness of it or at the subject under discussion.
"For those of us with our boots on the ground, it doesn't matter what the causes. We're too busy dealing with the effects."
He looked as weary as anyone I'd ever seen when he said,
"Adi, what should I be doing to stop whatever's coming? What do you need from me?"
"I don't know yet, sir. We just learned they're planning this for May, possibly this week."
"We?"
The chief looked puzzled.
"You have a new posse?"
"Something like that, yes."
"Other law enforcement?"
"Not exactly."
"When do I meet them?"
"At the right time. You've got to trust me on this, Chief. I don't like keeping anything from you, but that's how it has to be right now."
"This is my town to protect, son. I don't tolerate vigilantes."
"No, sir, that's not what this is." We engaged in a staring contest, after which he sighed and said,
"If I can't trust you, I can't trust myself. Forget your posse for now. What more do you know about the bad guys?"
"All I have is three names. Wolfgang, Jonathan, Celine. Those might not even be their real names. I never saw their faces. I'll let you know the moment I have any kind of useful lead." Having presented his theories of societal collapse, Ozzy now addressed the buttered sweet roll rather than the chief or me.
"Lovely,"
and set about devouring it.
"Where are you staying?" Chief Porter asked.
"Not with any old friends in town. I won't put them at risk."
"Carla misses you, son. She'd love to see you."
Carla was the chief's wife, a kind and gracious lady who treated me far better than my real mother ever did. "I'd love to see her too, sir. We'll get together soon, when this is over." My words drew Ozzy's attention from the cinnamon roll.
"So you didn't come home to die?"
I could have said to them that the prospect of my death wasn't what brought me home to Pico Mundo, but that were death to find me in the course of this mission, I would have no regrets and, more to the point, would go through that dark door with more gratitude than fear. They might interpret those words as proof of a suicidal disposition. I was not suicidal, however, only full of longing for the girl whom I'd lost. No need to worry my closest friends. And so I said,
No, sir. I came home because I'm needed here, and because she's here. In spite of my assurances, Ozzie appeared no less worried.
Her ashes, you mean?
Yes, and in a way her too. All my memories of her are here. My surrogate fathers exchanged meaningful looks, but neither of them said anything. I figured they would be on their phones with each other by the time they left the park for the state highway. We packed the chafing dishes and plates and utensils and leftover food in boxes and coolers, and we loaded them into the spacious trunk of Ozzie's customized Cadillac.
"Not the remaining strawberries," Ozzie said,
taking possession of that bowl at the last minute.
"A weary traveler needs a snack to see him through a tedious journey."
"You'll be home in 15 minutes, sir."
"By the most direct series of streets, yes. But I may choose to take the scenic route."
"You didn't have to do all this," Chief Porter said to him. "A box of donuts would have been enough."
Ozzie pursed his lips and frowned in disapproval.
"Donuts for a police officer would be such a cliché. I make an effort to avoid clichés in my life every bit as much as I eschew them in my books."
Although he was a warm-hearted man, Wyatt Porter had never been as much of a hugger as Ozzie Boone. He wanted a hug anyway. I said, "Be sure to tell Carla I love her, and tell her not to worry about me."
"It's good to have you back, son. I hope your days of wandering are all behind you."
I watched them drive away. My attention was drawn to the lake by a sudden thrumming of wings and a chorus of low, hoarse croaks. 8 or 10 migrating egrets touched down where the beach met water and spread out along the shore, each respecting the other's hunting grounds. More than 3 feet tall, white but for their yellow bills and skinny black legs, moving slowly and with solemn deliberation, they stalked the shallows for their breakfast. They speared small, wriggling fish from the water and tilted their heads to let the catch slide, still alive, down their long, sleek throats, and I wondered if even in the small brain of a little fish there might be a capacity for terror. 11. The night before my return to Pico Mundo, the seaside cottage where I and Anna Maria and young Tim slept in separate rooms. Windows open for the sea air. Born on that faintest of breezes came the lulling susurration of the gentle surf breaking on the shore. In the still and ordered cottage, I endured a dream of chaos and cacophony. Shrill screams of terror, screams of glee. Through smears of light that blur my vision, faces leer, loom, but then swoon from me. Hands pulling, pushing, plucking, slapping. Through it all, the eerie tortured wail and bleat and chirr and howl that might have been what passed for music in an alien world without harmony. Although I'd never been drunk in my life, I seemed to be drunk in the dream, reeling across ground that yawed like the deck of a storm-tossed ship. Wrapped in my arms, held to my chest, an urn, a mortuary urn. I heard myself calling Stormy's name, but this was not the urn that held her ashes. Somehow I knew this urn contained the remains of dead people beyond counting. Ribbons of darkness suddenly wound through the whirl of blurring light so that I feared that blindness would overcome me. The booming of my heart grew louder, louder, until it exceeded in volume the 100 other sources of dissonance combined. Out of the seething crowd, out of the light and the darkness, came Blossom Rosedale, the one and only happy monster, which was a name she'd given herself, not because she loathed the way she looked, but because she was truly happy in spite of all her suffering. Without realizing that I had staggered to a genuflection, I was on one knee when her left hand, scarred by fire, lacking all digits other than the thumb and forefinger, cupped my chin and lifted my bowed head,
bringing me face to face with her. She said with great emotion, "Adi, no. Oh, no, no." I'd met her in Magic Beach back in January. We had quickly become fast friends, each of us a different kind of outsider. 45 years earlier, when she'd been only 6, her drunken father had, in a fit of rage, dropped her headfirst into a barrel of trash that he'd set afire with a little kerosene. She toppled the barrel and crawled out, but by then she was aflame. Surgeons saved one ear and somewhat rebuilt her nose, reconstructed her lips. She had no hair thereafter, and her face remained seamed and puckered by terrible keloid scars that no surgeon could smooth away. Never before had I dreamed of Blossom, but emerging from the chaos of this nightmare, she helped me to my feet and said that I should lean on her. For reasons I didn't understand, I warned her away, insisted that I would be the death of anyone near me, but she would not be dissuaded. Although she was but 5 feet tall and more than twice my age, she gave me the strength that I needed to lurch forward through the growing bedlam, through the blurred dreamlight and gyrating dream shadows, through the screaming multitude, toward what, I could not guess, toward what proved to be the Amaranth. 12. The old but well-kept house stood on 3 or 4 acres beyond the city limits of Pico Mundo, a 2-story Victorian structure with a deep front porch and lots of gingerbread, painted white with pale blue trim. A long blacktop driveway led between colonnades of velvet ash trees,